This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for February 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we'll hear from Lisa Russ Sparr.
Soul is an old thirst, but not as first as the bodies, perhaps.
Sarah Peters.
We joke so long and rough, the joke morphs, till we're practicing for our future rapes.
And we're going to talk with Peter Campion about Mad Tom.
He stands in for our ideas about identity itself.
In the magazine this month, we have a portfolio of the painter Joan Mitchell, along with essays about her by Lydia Davis, Paul Auster, Marjorie Perloff, and several others who knew her and admired her strikingly beautiful abstract paintings.
And Joan Mitchell had a connection with Poetry Magazine. Her mother, the poet and writer Marion Strobel, worked as an associate editor at Poetry from 1920 to 1925 and was part of things around here for many years afterwards.
So Joan Mitchell grew up here in Chicago, and it was a very highly literary environment. And later on, she went on to become friends with many of the New York School poets.
The portfolio in the magazine coincides with an exhibition here at the Poetry Foundation featuring some of Joan Mitchell's work, as well as her connections with the magazine and with poetry more generally. That's all illustrated in that exhibition, so if you're in Chicago, stop by.
The main prose piece in this issue is a meditation on poetry by our longtime contributor, W.S.D. Piero. It's called Mickey Rourke and the Bluebird of Happiness, a notebook. It's got a tantalizing title. As for the poetry itself in the issue, we don't actually have a lot of poems this month.
And that's because one of the poems, the first in the issue, is quite long. It's by Joshua Meegan, and it's called The Orange Bottle, and it begins like this.
The clear orange bottle was empty. It had been empty a day. It suddenly seemed so costly and uncalled for anyway.
2 years had passed. They had passed more or less the way years should. Maybe he changed, or maybe the doctors had misunderstood.
The poem gallops through 12 more pages describing a psychotic episode that lands the speaker in a mental hospital. And it ends with him moving to a halfway house.
Well, as you can imagine, when we first read the poem, we had to figure out what to make of it all. But it's quite ingenious, and I think it's very unusual. And I think in a certain way, I mean, not to put the onus on the poet or on us, it's a little Prufrockian. I mean, I think it has that feel of an unusual textured vocalization of something that's just in the air and feels very contemporary. But it's also a very ambitious poem, and it's unusual in its voicing.
Very unusual. And part of what's so unusual in it is the formal quality. It has a faux ballad rhythm to it. It's not exactly a ballad, but it often is. And he varies that quite a bit.
Yeah.
But it has this combination of extreme confidence that you get in like a poet like W.H. Auden or James Merrill, coupled with disturbance and trauma that you get in Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
It's a weird mix. You get lines like this. Don't take me, cried the clozapine. Yes, don't, cried the medication. And the bright yellow morning seemed suddenly edged with a shady fascination. Why should he go to his workplace? Who was his supervisor? He had a sickening feeling that he was becoming wiser. It's funny and it's not, right? It's
sort
of edged with the illness. It's a very real illness in the poem.
Really, the drugs are speaking literally and figuratively,
right.
I guess.
Right.
It's almost a little out of Lewis Carroll there. I mean, the poem really, it runs a little wild with its imagination, yet it's always very searingly and intensely rational. I mean, this is a very sharp thinker behind this work.
Yeah. There's another part here where you can feel the form breaking apart. His walk was stiffened by fear, but it took him where he was going, into the terrible world of children and daffodils growing, and friendly people helloing, and the super outdoing the mowing, and the two old sisters out in wool sweaters with their wrinkled cheeks pinkly glowing, and the pretty lady who would give birth by Christmas barely showing but showing, and the policeman helping to keep the lazy afternoon traffic flowing, and time itself slowing, and none of them knowing. So suddenly that rhyme gets hit over and over
right.
and over all the time.
Right. But, you know, even that where you stopped where he says none of them knowing, then there's a stanza break and it continues that an odious axis was forming. I mean, so just when you think you know what he's going to do with all the rhyming and stuff like that, then it's sort of arresting that an odious axis was forming. That slows you down.
Yeah, and also enlarges the scene, right? It makes his personal problems seem universal, an axis, like an axis of evil, right?
right, exactly.
Lisa Russ Sparr was first in the magazine in 1994, before our tenure here, Don, but we have also published a few of her poems during the time that we've been here. In fact, there were a few exactly 3 years ago this month.
That's just a coincidence.
Yeah.
So now we do have three new poems, two of which are part of a series of temple poems.
I remember being interested to learn that a temple, which I associate with a sacred place, a place for devotion, was also cognate or related to the word tome.
One meaning of tome is a part of a book, and the conflated idea of a book or a series of poems as a place of worship is what got her started.
That allowed me to attach what I'm often interested in, which is the sacred and the erotic, to bring those two together.
Here's her introduction to and reading of Temple on My Knees.
Temple on My Knees plays with the phrase, which is familiar idiomatically, I think, to be thrown to your knees or to be on one's knees in supplication. I hope that the feeling of both being prayerful but also being in a position of petitioning or asking for forgiveness, as well as being stunned, are all present in the reading of this poem. Temple on My Knees. When this day returns to me, I will value your heart, long hurt in long division, over mine. Mouth above mine too, say you love me. Truth nevermore meant, say you are angry. Words, words we net with our mouths. Soul is an old thirst, but not as first as the body's perhaps, though on bad nights its melancholy eats us out to a person. True, time is undigressing, yet true is all we can be, rhyming you, rhyming me.
You know, one of the things that sometimes frustrates me about contemporary poetry is that you don't often get these moments in the poems that are sort of extractable, mm-hmm. the way you used to get in poems that you, you know, the abstract statements. And we put on the back cover of this issue these lines, soul is an old thirst, but not as first as the body's perhaps, which is great. And, and it ends.
Though on bad nights, its melancholy eats us out to a person.
Very striking, memorable phrasing, first of all, but also just meaning the melancholy of soul or soulfulness or the need to have a soul or thinking you have a soul, whatever you want to phrase it, eats us out to a person. To a person has two meanings there. It means it's every single one of us, but it also devours us down to our personhood. The act of soul reduces us to not having one in a way.
I think some of the sounds and preoccupations of these poems is Auden-esque in some ways. I mean, of course, this is a far more kind of up-to-date rendering of these things, but it reminds me of, you know, the crack in the teacup. It's kind of working on two planes at once, the everyday life with its bad nights and corrosive melancholy, but also, as you say, the larger things that we used to get out of a poem, yet true is all we can be, rhyming you, rhyming me. I mean, I think it takes courage now to write lines like that and confidence in the rhythm of lines like that to make them work.
Let's hear another poem by Lisa Russ Sparr. This one is called How I Might Sound If I Left Myself Alone.
Turning to watch you leave, I see we must always walk toward other loves, river of heaven between two office buildings, orphaned cloud, fish soup poppling, book spined in the open palm, unstoppable light. I think it is all right, or due tonight, garden toad, a speaking stone, young sound in an old heart. Annul the self, I float it, a daylily in my wine. Oblivion, I love our lives, keeping me from it.
I like the way this has the same seriousness as the other poem, same universal gestures in it, but we get these questions from a toad.
Right.
A speaking stone. Annul the self. Is this an answer to existence? Can you, if you can annul the self, or are you worried about oblivion? Well, it's the toad answering these questions. Right.
And you sort of are forced to think of all the great toad poems, you know, like Marianne Moore's, you know, and maybe Larkin's too. it seems to ricochet off of at least the Marianne Moore there. In other words, what is this garden being imagined, and who is the toad, the inscrutable toad?
Garden toad, a speaking stone, young sound in an old heart.
Wow.
That's wonderful. And the poem also has this great use of that word poppling.
Orphaned cloud, fish soup poppling.
Which is a sort of rippling water. It's perfect.
I remember years ago when I used to work with old tapes of poets reading their work, there was a Zhukovsky poem, and he used the word pother in it, but he didn't like the recording because he said people hear it and think he said bother.
Yeah.
So that plosiveness is a great and rare thing in a poem when the fish soup is poppling. That's pretty good right there. And then, of course, the next line.
Book spined in the open palm, unstoppable light.
Unstoppable.
Right. She picked up that sound
again.
Yeah. This is the first appearance of Sarah Peters in the magazine. She was recently a Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and her first book, 1996, comes out this spring.
We have two of her poems, and the first one we're going to hear is The Last Time I Slept in This Bed.
The Last Time I Slept in This Bed. I was involved in the serious business of ripping apart my own body. I'd run my fingers over it, seeking but never finding the right point of entry, so having to tear one myself. Though midway through, I'd always tire and let night enter like a silver needle, sewing my eyelids shut. This was not an original practice, but thinking for a time that it was felt like being able to choose when spring would arrive, engineering an April that opened like a parasol, even in thoroughest winter.
This is a disturbing poem.
Yeah.
I love the lines, I'd always tire and let night enter like a silver needle. Even night with its consolations has a cutting quality to it. And also this beautiful bit felt like being able to choose when spring would arrive, engineering an April that opened like a parasol, that combination of the mechanical and the natural, engineering an April.
Yeah, even in thoroughest winter, which,
thoroughest,
you know, here we are in the winter, and that is a great phrase for the way it feels now. And what threads through this poem is actually that stuff with her fingers, you know, running her fingers over, ripping apart her body, tearing points of entry, letting night enter like a silver needle. That's sort of an external piercing. Mm-hmm. And so engineering an April that opens like a parasol. I mean, there's something redemptive about that.
Oh, yeah. I think in a way you could read it as a metaphor for writing poetry itself, you know, that there's some kind of self-destructiveness to a lot of creative acts, that the creative act itself redeems or heals in some way. There is something redemptive at the end, some suggestion that the speaker is maybe, I mean, moved on, even the title, right? That we got The Last Time I Slept in This Bed, there's a suggestion maybe this was in the past, maybe it was a time during adolescence, or maybe not, maybe it was just a time of adulthood that the speaker has gotten past.
Right, past and has been awakened from.
Let's hear another poem from Sarah Peters. This one also concerns a violation of the body.
It's a poem in which two sisters have a discussion about rape, and the discussion begins in a very flippant way, and then it becomes very serious.
Here's Sarah Peters reading Rehearsal.
I am walking through water with one of my sisters, the river banked with tiger lilies, the sun like having a lemon juiced into your eye. Our senile dog, ecstatic behind us, and I am yammering about my discovery, a chest-deep pool sentried by trees that caterpillars were killing with their yearly carnival tents. We reach, then ruin the pool with oils and shampoos. We scrub too much skin from our heels, then debate whether to sunbathe naked, that is, who is hiding in the woods. We joke so long and rough, the joke morphs, till we're practicing for our future rapes. We both have numbers that we know are up. My sister's ears are speared with porcupine quills and steel, but she's placed her straw hat carefully over her stomach. As she talks, I watch while dragonflies and other, less showy insects land on her burning shoulders. The dragonflies present their stenciled wings. I can't remember what the others do. My sister spits to clean each sunglass mirror. She wants me to hear how, when it happens, she'll do this scream. But when the scream comes, it's just like she's opened a shaken bottle of sparkling water. I am speechless only for the view of her throat's cushioned corridor. But when the scream ends, her eyes have broken off from the rest of her face. She takes our green net bag full of oranges and slams it down on the baking rocks, beating the ground till the oranges soften and streak the air with the smell of their breaking.
I guess the question that any reader would ask immediately is it self-dramatizing? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, melodramatic? We're practicing for our future rape. So I read an article the other day that 1 in 3 American girls under the age of 17 is sexually molested. 1 in 3. I mean, it's a shockingly high number. So I think the poem is not at all melodramatic. It warrants the issue it raises, and it treats it very seriously. There's a couple things that are striking to me. I was walking through water with one of my sisters. Why not just say with my sister? And it says, we joke so long and rough, the joke morphs till we're practicing for our future rapes. We both have numbers that we know are up. Which suggests that maybe the speaker knows these statistics, or maybe something happened to one of their other sisters or friends or something.
That absent sister is very haunting.
Right.
And it's hard to know what happened to her, if she's older or younger, more experienced, if she's gone away to be in another kind of life than these sisters who are somehow closer, at mm-hmm. least in this narration of things. But that absence is very haunting, especially in light of how full the poem is.
It's striking also how the fruit changes, right? The sun at the beginning is like having a lemon juiced into your eye, which is unpleasant. But then at the end, this girl or young woman, however old she is, she breaks these oranges. And so she becomes the agent for this. It's like she's reacting against the natural world with this independent action. That's a powerful action at the end, just to shatter all these oranges.
Yeah, it's full of things being pierced and breaking and being squashed. There's a lot of hard-to-cope-with activity here. My sister's ears are speared with porcupine quills and steel.
Yeah.
It is a tormented and, in a way, tormenting poem.
Mm-hmm. It's meant to say she's tough, right? And then, but then we've got that butt right after butt. She's placed her straw hat carefully over her stomach, so she's done some gesture of protectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I think the poem is, you know, presents both the speaker and the other sister as sort of worldly tough figures and yet vulnerable.
Yeah, I think they do that by a kind of dissociation. You know,
well, that's right, because that before the scream ends, her eyes have broken off from the rest of her face.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's almost like they are forced to separate themselves in a way from their bodies whose numbers are up. It's terrifying.
Last month in the January issue, we had a section of antagonisms, which were short essays by poets about famous poets that they didn't particularly like. We're making amends this month with appreciations written by the very same poets.
So instead of Michael Robbins giving Dylan Thomas the business, as he did last month, we have Michael Robbins praising poems by Algernon Charles Swinburne.
And we have Daisy Freed talking up Kenneth Fearing, Angie Malenko on the obscure modernist Lynette Roberts, Laura Kosciski on the 16th century Englishman Thomas Tusser, Jason Guriel on the fake poets of an English poetry hoax, and we have Peter Campion on Mad Tom.
Peter Campion's on the phone with us from the University of Minnesota, where he teaches.
So, Peter, Mad Tom is not actually a poet of flesh and blood, yet you say he exists. Can you just tell us, who is he? Who is this guy? And give us a bit of his bio.
Yeah, he's a figure of English folklore. Back in the day in England, they would let out the insane asylums, much like the Reagan era, in the United States, and there'd be all these beggars around. And probably his most famous appearance and earliest famous appearance is in King Lear, when Edgar appears to Lear as Tom O'Bedlam, and he says, "Bless thy five wits. Tom's a cold. Oh, do-de-do-de-do. Bless thee from whirlwinds, star blasting and taking. Do poor Tom some charity whom the foul fiend vexes. There, that I have him now. And there again. And there." Lear sees him after that, and, you know, Lear, it's tremendously narcissistic. He thinks everything relates to him. And the first thing he says, this line of Pentameter, is, "Has his daughters brought him to this pass?" There was never one living Mad Tom. But I have the sense that as a folkloric figure, Mad Tom is about, he stands in for our ideas about identity itself and about authorship itself, about who has control of our language, how we control it, or how it controls us.
Are you the first person to identify Mad Tom as a major poet in English, or did you hear about him from somebody else?
I'm definitely the first, Don, to identify him. And please, if anybody claims otherwise, you know that they're lying. But the anonymous poem, which I wrote about in the piece, I first heard read by Derek Walcott. Walcott, as you know, has put Mad Tom as a character in some of his poems, mm-hmm. really to a wonderful effect. One thing that's so interesting about the Mad Tom poem, the anonymous poem, is he's really suffering. I mean, it's tremendously agonizing, even though it's hilarious and obscene and both at once.
We should get you to read a little bit of this.
Sure.
So people can hear it.
Well, I'll read the beginning where he's warning the reader, in a sense, not to become crazy. And he talks about himself in the third person, which is another reason I think that this is a poem about authorship and about identity. Point of view changes, even though the person stays central. From the hag and hungry goblin that into rags would rend ye, and the spirit that stands by the naked man in the book of moons defend ye. That of your five sound senses you never be forsaken, nor wander from yourselves with palm abroad to beg your bacon. Wandering from yourselves, I love that. Let me read the two stanzas that are quoted in the piece. I know more than Apollo, for oft when he lies sleeping, I see the stars at bloody wars in the wounded welkin weeping. The moon embrace her shepherd, and the queen of love her warrior, while the first doth horn the star of morn, and the next the heavenly farrier.
Yeah, that's great. You talk in the end of your piece about that combination of arrogance and diffidence, that both those examples are sort of perfect at that. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and that's one of the main tonal variations that happens, is that he's very pompous, but he's not at all arrogant. He has a great joie de vivre and pluck, and musicians call it tack. I mean, he reminds me of Art Blakey on the drums. It's just, boom, right at you. Pure showmanship and pure musicianship at the same time, even though he's very controlled, of course. I mean, I made a point in the piece that actual mad speech, in my limited, thank God, experience of it, is quite tedious, and it's actually the opposite of what we think of as the pleasure of mad speech in Shakespeare and in others, which is extravagance and speed of association, and metaphorical craftiness.
But do you think that tone or that voice is actually becoming more common? I mean, do you see that sort of antic spirit in contemporary poets, or more prevalent in contemporary poetry?
Yeah, I mean, I have been thinking about Mad Tom in light of contemporary poetry, and I'll try not to be grouchy about it. I think there's something that sort of passes for the poetry of Mad Tom these days, which is really a kind of disembodied verbal Sudoku, slicing and dicing of different idioms and patching them together. But there's not, in this purely straw man poetry that I'm talking about right now, there's not a real sense of a self, even if it's a divided self, even if it's a completely unstable self. There's not a sense of the person who suffers and who is guilty and ashamed and joyous and falls in love and out of love and all these things. I mean, many poets do now believe, you know, in the acoustic universe, to use a Marshall McLuhan's kind of outdated but strangely apt description. But I think it leads people to become more directors than actors. They're outside of their poems and they're cutting and pasting stuff together. I don't like that very much. What I do like is when people use voices in an incarnational way, you know, that a voice feels embodied, even if it's disembodied, even if it's coming out of nowhere or crazy or discontinuous.
Hmm. Well, Peter, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, guys.
You can read Peter Campion's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the February 2013 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.